If you're wondering how to navigate government or grow your business or even secure funding for your nonprofit, then this is the podcast for you. Here on Lobbying Insider, we take a look at the intersection between business and government and show how things actually get done. I'm your host, Zach Fink, Director of External Affairs at Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron. Welcome to the program. And we are joined by Randy Pierce, who's the president and CEO of the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce. Randy, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Let me ask you, as the largest chamber of commerce in New York State, there might be a lot of people who are not even totally sure what that involves. Obviously, there's extra and added responsibility, given how many members you probably have. But walk me through some of the major issues you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
So we, first of all, our chamber was founded in 1918. We are the voice of the Brooklyn business community, and we've been doing this a long time. And technically, it's three corporations. We've got the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce, which is your traditional membership association, 501c6 organization. We have an economic development arm called Brooklyn Alliance, which was chartered in the 1960s. That enables us to actually partner with government and with philanthropy in order to do technical assistance programs that support small businesses throughout the borough. And then in 2017, we chartered a CDFI, Community Development Financial Institution. So we're actually a micro lender, and we have a lending arm that could support small businesses. These are mostly businesses that can't access financing through banks and other institutions. So we've got a pretty broad-based portfolio. In addition, we have an international division. You know, Brooklyn has become an international brand. We host a lot of foreign delegations when they come to New York because they want to understand why all their kids are talking about Brooklyn. But in addition to that, we do three trade missions a year. So that's sort of outbound, where we're helping small businesses to get products overseas. And now we're working inbound with foreign startups, mostly from South Korea and from Singapore, who want to test their products on a more global marketplace like Brooklyn. So we'll do POC projects, proof of concept projects, test beds. To really give them the information they need about their products so that they could actually come to the United States and go direct to consumer or B2B, whatever the case may be. But mostly what we're doing is really four things: promotion, support, advocacy, and convening. So promotion is about our members, and there are 1,600 members in the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce, but we serve over 6,000 businesses a year. But promotion is about the businesses themselves. How do we tell their story so that they get the exposure, so that they can sell more products and get more customers? We do that through our communications arm. We do that through our e-newsletter. We do that through our networking events. Support is all of our technical assistance programs. We run several formal programs in partnership with government. We run the Brooklyn Business Solutions Center, for example, at 9 Bond Street, in partnership with the New York City Department of Small Business Services. We run a program called the Small Business Resource Network, which we launched during COVID, which is really a case management approach to helping small businesses where they're at. We've got field teams that go out and literally knock on doors and work directly with small businesses. Advocacy is our legislative and policy work, where, you know, we're representing the business community on the issues that are really impacting them day to day. You know, a small business owner doesn't have time to go to a public hearing or, you know, take time off from work to do testimony or you know, even meet with elected officials. So we represent them in that respect, at least the businesses in Brooklyn. And then convening is just bringing businesses together. And we do that many times through our industry committees. So we have some really important industry-based committees. We've got an energy committee. We've got a healthcare and life sciences committee. We've got a tech committee. We've got a real estate committee. We also have a government affairs committee. So that's about bringing, you know, like businesses together around shared interests and issues. So we do a lot.
Yeah, no, it sounds like it. And that's a pretty diverse portfolio right there. But you mentioned something earlier, which I wanted to jump back to for a minute. You said that there are certain businesses that may not be able to get loans from banks.
Right.
Why is that? And how are you guys able to do it and guarantee that you're going to get the return on your investment?
That's a great question. So part of it is size. You know, we're talking about what we'll call micro businesses, businesses that whose revenue is less than $200,000 a year. Maybe they have one or two employees at most. So part of it is that they just don't have the scale themselves to access, loans and other things. But many times these are small businesses whose credit scores are not where they need to be. Maybe their, you know, tax filings are not up to snuff. We saw a lot of this during COVID, particularly with PPP. So think about this base of businesses that did not qualify for PPP.
But huge loans coming out of Washington.
Huge loans coming out of Washington, yeah. But you know, their payroll was sketchy. Their taxes weren't filed properly. So we actually pioneered during COVID, in partnership with the Social Justice Fund, which is the Joe and Clara Tsai Foundation, the owners of the Brooklyn Nets. We pioneered the Brooklyn Accelerate Loan Program, which was a character-based lending program for these types of businesses, right? The ones that weren't getting PPP. Basically, we changed the underwriting equation for these businesses. We didn't rely on credit scores, guarantors, and collateral. We actually relied on a character-based reference from someone of stature in the community. So it could have been another business owner. It could have been a community board official. It could have been a pastor or religious leader in the community. These are businesses that had been serving the community for decades, but flew under the radar. And they just needed to be verified that they've been in business, right? They've been, you know, baking cocoa bread, cutting hair, running a restaurant. And that to me, I think, is really the innovation. Was we didn't interest rates are, we had low interest rates. We're always going to have lower interest rates in the banks. But the reality is it's the underwriting that keeps a lot of these, mostly MWBE businesses, right, out of access for capital. So we have to kind of rethink if we really truly want to help the smallest of these small businesses, the ones that are most disadvantaged in the communities, we got to rethink the underwriting criteria.
And I guess with some of these financial institutions, right, like they need more guarantees, whereas you can do, given that you're part of the community, you can sort of take a leap of faith with people you might have worked with before, people know each other. It's a little more in network based, right, rather than strict commercial standards.
You're 100% right. That was exactly the theory behind the program.
That's really great. And so that I would imagine made a huge difference, because I know there was a period, I'm sure, you know, given what you were seeing and looking down the barrel of a gun during, you know, COVID, that there was a real risk there that all these businesses would go under, that brings, you know, loses jobs. I mean, we were on the brink.
And all these businesses needed, just like everyone else, was cash to reopen the doors.
To keep everything open, right?
And you know, we did.
But they don't have the traffic, right? So that's the problem.
Yeah, they didn't have the track record, like in the financial markets. But you know, we did 250,000 overall. I'm sorry, 2.5 million overall. The chamber did 850,000 in microloans, so up to 15K at 0% interest. True Fund, our partner, did up to 100K at 2% interest, so it was still the cheapest money that you were going to find for a small business. And we literally saved hundreds of businesses through this program alone.
I would imagine. Yeah. That was really tough there for a while. Let me ask you a little bit about your retail division and dealing with retail in the age of the internet, in the changing face of it. I mean, I you go downtown and you see what's happening in Manhattan, at least, right? That there's a lot of empty storefronts. Unimaginable 20 years ago, but nowadays you see it. I mean, are you having the same problem? I know that Brooklyn went through this unprecedented growth spurt, right? In terms of people wanting to be there, and businesses and people moving there. So has that impact? I can't imagine it hasn't impacted it, but I guess my question to you, how has it impacted it?
So I'm kind of smiling. Your listeners, you know, should envision me smiling when you ask this question, because it's not a bad idea for a chamber of commerce to actually run a business.
Okay.
Because then we get to feel the same pain.
Right. You know it. You're right.
Firsthand. I've been there, brother. As our members. Look, it's not easy to run a small business in New York City. And there's a lot of cost factors that are at play here. So little background here. So our stores are Brooklyn-made stores. And we do have an online platform too, Brooklyn Made Stores, brooklynmadestore.com. But we have two brick and mortar stores. We have one at Industry City. We also have one at City Point in downtown Brooklyn. We just did a foreign pop-up too in the Sugama region in Tokyo, which we're wrapping up. So we got a little international play as well. We do corporate gifting. We do pop-ups, like we're in Celebrate Brooklyn, the concert series at Prospect Park. We're the merch provider. So we got a lot of different sort of verticals there. But, you know, we launched the first store in 2023, and we're still not profitable minus grants. Now, our benefactor, our strong benefactor, has been Wells Fargo Foundation. They have been incredible and behind this program because it really is a social mission. We're working with over 200 independent makers and designers, mostly from all the neighborhoods in Brooklyn, mostly MWBE makers that are making incredible products, everything from apparel to home goods like candles and dish towels and packaged food goods like hot sauces. And then we've got an art gallery in each of the stores. We've got pet products, you name it. It's really cool Brooklyn stuff. We wouldn't be able to do it if Brooklyn didn't have the cachet that it does in terms of the brand itself.
The hell of a brand. Yeah.
Right.
It just in and of itself.
Yeah. But, and we're trending in the right direction. We're not completely unprofitable, but we're close. I think the biggest, and this gets to your little bit to your question. I think the biggest challenge for us right now is online. Our in-person stores do pretty well. City Point does very well. Industry City does very well. But online sales are about 6% of our overall sales. If we can notch that up to, more of the industry standard between 10 and 15%, we're profitable. Mm-hmm. So we're close. We're on the cusp. But it's all on the cost side of the equation, I have to tell you. And, people don't want to talk about this, but labor costs in New York are just extraordinary.
Yeah.
And we are, if not the highest, I think we're the highest labor costs anywhere in the country. And, when we pass laws that impact small businesses, or when we pass laws that impact business, we tend to be disproportionately hurting small businesses because the corporates generally meet the standards, right? So just, we can look at that across when we say, labor costs, we can look at that when we say insurance costs, utilities, you name it. So we're getting there. And it's been a tremendous learning experience for me personally to operate these stores. We've got a great team. We've got great support in Wells Fargo. We also get support from Brooklyn.org, the borough's community foundation. And for us, it's a mission to really help these independent makers and designers, and that's how we grow the local economy.
Well, and you say labor costs. I mean, that's the ongoing kind of joke, and it's not really a joke because it's so difficult, but you can't even put down new track for the Second Avenue subway because it's so prohibitively expensive in terms of the labor costs, right? So it's, projects that used to get done in this city, you almost can't do them anymore because they just, you're paralyzed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, look, this is an expensive city. And we know that, people's salaries have to really justify the work that they do. But we're retail. We are, straight up, brick and mortar retail. And it's tough. It's really tough. But we're in a better position than most. Our stores have the backing of the Chamber of Commerce, and all the advantages that bring. But like I said, for me to understand firsthand, the challenges that our businesses are going through from the cost side of the equation is important.
And I would imagine you want to open up markets outside of Brooklyn, obviously, to sell some of these products. I'm just curious, how did you get to Japan? I mean, was there more interest there in Tokyo than perhaps other areas of the world?
It's great. It's a great question. We do a lot of work with Asia. We do a lot. Like I said, we were doing some work with Korea. We're doing some work with Singapore inbound. And we had developed a partnership with a university in Tokyo called Taisho University, Buddhist University. And they operate a couple of different retail businesses as sort of part of their, sort of curriculum with the students in this area of Tokyo called Sugamo. And they had and we met them here in Brooklyn because they had a partnership with J. Calabo, which is in Park Slope, which is a Japanese sort of cultural center. Coming together in the minds, and they said, we've got this empty storefront. Would you consider doing a pop up? For us, they would provide the students to do the labor, to manage the store. For the students, it was a part of their learning experience, right? They had the real estate as well, so we really needed to provide the product and the licensing, right? I guess, in that sense, it was like a licensing agreement, and we were sourcing the product. We're wrapping up a three month engagement at the end of this month. It's really been great. I mean, the students, the Taisho students, they're amazing. They're so, you know, hardworking, and they so want to learn, and they so want to understand. And you know, Brooklyn itself plays well in Japan. I mean, it's you can go down any street in Tokyo, and you'll see Brooklyn, you know, apparel. We had the real authentic apparel that we were selling, and not the knockoff stuff. Right. But it's been a really good run, and we wouldn't have been able to do it if we didn't have this partnership with Taisho, because, you know, obviously it's not easy to open up an actual business somewhere overseas, and in Asia in particular, you have to usually do it through a subsidiary. So in that sense, having a partner like Taisho enabled us to actually do this.
But going back to the brand, right? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty cool that in some places far away as Tokyo, the Brooklyn brand has that much star power and selling power.
Yeah, it is pretty incredible. I, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, 70s, 80s, and 90s, I never would have, you know, we were hesitant to even tell people we're from Brooklyn back then. And now, you know, people are wearing it on their hoodies and on their sweatshirts. And you know, you go anywhere in the world and see people wearing a Yankees hat, but they don't know they're wearing a Yankees hat. But right. when they're wearing something that says Brooklyn on it, they know it's
and
Brooklyn.
And people, young people generally know exactly what it is.
Exactly.
Right? There's a cachet attached
that's
to it,
right.
I think you said earlier. I think that's a good point. Wanted to touch on politics a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the political environment now for businesses. Obviously, there was great concern from the business community. I realize there's different facets of the business community, but given the sort of DSA track record, which tends to be, you know, at least outwardly anti-business, and there was concern that if a DSA-affiliated mayor became mayor, that it would shift rapidly the climate against businesses. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you found that, or have you found an ability of this administration to try and reach out and work with business collectively?
Sort of two things here. The first is that I think his track, it's early, right? I mean, you know, we're half a year in a new administration, and there's still work to do on the business side of things. EDC, selecting an EDC president, for example, is crucial. You know, that said, I think the mayor's had a good run so far. And in sort of the business sector overall, and in other ways, it's even easier for him and his core constituencies to get behind small businesses, right? I mean, everybody loves small businesses, or at least they profess that. And, you know, from our perspective, Brooklyn Chamber's perspective, you know, we work across the political spectrum, right? So we on the ground, we work very well with some DSA affiliated members. We work very well with other legislators as well, from all parts of the political spectrum. And you know, for small business, everybody wants to support small business. It talks about they're the heart and soul of the neighborhood. I would say, Zach, to be quite honest, the administration is too young for me to make an assessment right now about how effective they are in terms of supporting small business. Today, I just came from this press conference on the executive order, open for business here in New York, where the mayor announced 50 regulatory changes that are going to make it easier for business. And I'm hopeful about things like that. But also the city council has a lot to do with the business climate for small businesses in New York City. And I'm going to be a little critical here, because I would say over the last decade, it's been the city council that's really passed quite a bit of legislation that has disproportionately hurt small businesses in a negative way. Less so in any one administration, let alone the Mamdani administration right now, but more so like some of the legislative challenges that the city council has created are things that I'd like to see us try and undo. We're starting to do that. You know, last week I was with the speaker and a couple of council members talking about cut the red tape bill.
Regulatory hurdles that are unnecessary and onerous, particularly to your members, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, right.
And the big ones can afford it. So
the big ones can afford it, or they're already meeting the mandate, right? So, but there's been a whole series of them. And in and of themselves, if you take any one piece of legislation the council has passed, there was a reason, a pretty good reason behind it. But collectively, when you layer them on top of each other, it's just been like a tremendous burden on the small business community. Yeah. You know, we lost net 4,000 businesses in the city last year, the first time since COVID that we had a net loss of businesses.
That's a terrible statistic.
That's a terrible statistic. It should be a red flag. But when you talk about, you know, just cause termination laws, when you talk about, you know, paid sick time laws, when you talk about fair work week laws, and you just pile it on and on and on and on and on, and then you add to the mix fines and violations, which everyone wants to talk about addressing, and I absolutely want to see those addressed. But it's this cumulative impact, which almost it makes you have to scratch your head of, like, you know, why anybody would want to try and open a small business.
Do we want our businesses to thrive or not?
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
You know, going back to ideology and the mayor, and, you know, there is really no ideological way to govern a city that has such pressing demands day to day, right? There's nothing partisan about garbage pickup or snow removal or emergency vehicles getting where they need to be. I'll give you another reason where I would also agree with you that the mayor's had a pretty good run and been successful. This is an X factor that has nothing to do with governing. The New York Knicks, right?
That's right.
First world championship in 50 years. It just had this cheerlead. Yeah. He's like the top cheerleader for the city. And that was such an event that made everyone so excited to be in this city. And I think, you know, having done all this work, you know, with the business community, that enthusiastic, you know, retail, you know, people who are going to actually spend money, enthusiastic people on the streets, whatever it's about, it's all a help.
Yeah. Yeah, you couldn't have teed up a better situation for a mayor, of stylistically too, right? I mean, played to his strengths about, you know, the underdog coming through and then, you know, rising to victory. And he was a Knicks fan too. I wish it would have played out with the Mets, because I know he's also a Mets fan. But
Our year.
But we'll definitely take the Knicks. And
it rarely is our year.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, and Mayor talked about it today too, is just, you know, there was an economic boom from, you know, for small businesses with the run up to the Knicks championship, and that was real. I'm a little more skeptical about, you know, the World Cup boom that we should have gotten in the local economy, but the Knicks boom boost, I should say, was real. So it all played well. You're right, for the mayor, and he's a master at sort of communicating that sense of optimism
and joy.
that's exactly what he did through that run.
Yeah. No, I would totally agree. Mm-hmm. And let me ask you about the governor, because here's a position where you can insert a little more ideology, in the sense that I would argue the person who is the governor really can set policy. They lay it out in their State of the State speech. They negotiate with the legislature. But, you know, New York State really has a tremendous amount of power. New York City can't even really raise its own taxes, you know, without the say-so of the state government. So it does give the governor more power. I feel like the governor has really settled into this job. I think, you know, in some respects, you know, she obviously landed there in a very unexpected way. And, you know, it's a learning curve like anything else, but I feel like she's really kind of hit her groove.
I can't even recall a big misstep that this governor has made since she's taken office. I mean, she truly, and I think the fact that she has no real competition going into this election
speaks
cycle,
volumes, doesn't it?
Speaks volumes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she's done a phenomenal job. And you know, she's had to walk a line sometimes between, you know, the more progressive, you know, electorate here in New York City, but she's practical, she's smart, she's likable. I mean, and she's got a good team, and you know, even things that are uncomfortable, like CLCPA and the adjustments that we needed to make, the very real practical adjustments that we needed
these
to
are,
make.
These are the climate laws that some environmentalists are angry that the state, quote unquote, rolled back. But I would imagine people from your vantage point are looking at this and saying, they talk about onerous, I mean, and goals we couldn't meet. We had to do something.
The goals are worthy, and the governor will tell you this too. We're still going to get there, but we have to be realistic about the pathway.
Right.
And conditions change. You know, nothing is static.
Right. Costs go up, and also the notion of an imposition. You know, I understand that's the only way to do it, but you have to be flexible. You know, I always say when you're governing for 20 million people out of Albany, you have to be willing to look at stuff and say, "Hey, is this working?" To your point, right now
in
this climate.
That's right. And she's done it. I mean, she's been very, very deft at kind of navigating all of these things. And it shows. It shows in terms of her approval ratings. It shows in terms of the election cycle right now. And she, you know, it's, she's in the driver's seat, and as she should be, because she's done a phenomenal job.
And was able to get along with Mayor Adams and Mayor Mamdani,
yeah,
right? And could not be more ideologically on opposite sides of the coin. And I think that's a testament to rolling up your sleeves and saying what is best for the residents of the city and the state.
And not overreacting. When have you when have you ever seen the governor overreact?
No, it's
right?
true.
Like, yeah. you know, like even okay, when Mamdani pushed on the property tax thing a little bit, well, they're kind of like a threat, right? She didn't overreact.
No.
No, she's like, first of all, she probably sat back and shook her hands. So yeah,
good luck.
But,
yeah.
but she didn't overreact. She didn't take the bait.
No.
And look, and she delivered for the city, and she delivered for the mayor, you know, in a totally appropriate way. And, yeah. you know, so like, oh, this governor has done a phenomenal job, in my opinion. And I'm looking forward to, you know, 4 more years of her leadership.
You know, and I'll give the mayor some credit on that also. You know, he could have very easily run against that, right? Mm-hmm. Or he very yeah. easily could have yep. targeted the sort of, you know, by nature, the state is more conservative just
right.
in terms of its approach, right?
right.
And, you know, he didn't. He recognized he needs her help. He recognized that they're stronger together, that she represents a certain,
right.
you know, constituency within the Democratic Party, and he represents the emerging one. And they're stronger together than they
That's
are
right.
divided.
That's right, 100%.
You know, so I give some credit there. Quickly on the federal, I know we're headed into the mm-hmm. midterms. Obviously, New York is not a lot of competitive races. We really saw that more with the primaries. But is your sense that the road to control of the House is going to go through New York State?
Yeah, I think so. And I hope so. You know, I'll tell you, we don't weigh in as a chamber on a lot of, you know, federal policies, but I'll tell you too that have wreaked havoc on our local economy and our local small businesses. I mean, tariffs, number one, you know, in the beginning when they were all over the place and nobody knew, you know, how much they were going to pay and when, and I mean, that just caused havoc, especially in immigrant communities where you were sourcing from home and selling to your local community. And then the second thing, and we see this on the ground because we have, you know, field teams that do work in almost every neighborhood, even a whisper of ICE enforcement in a neighborhood, and there's all these WhatsApp chat groups. I mean, you know, if there's even a whisper of ICE enforcement, businesses shutter, you know, midday, and it takes a toll on local economy. I mean, I was in Bath Beach, heavy immigrant community in, you know, in South Brooklyn. And we were out 2:30 on a Wednesday doing corridor walks and, you know, businesses were shuttered. And they were, you look in the pier in the window, and you can see this product on the shelf and this was a functioning business, but in the middle of the day it was shuttered. And it was because we found out later that there was a concern that there was ICE enforcement in the area and it just immediately shut down.
Yeah,
it's
a good way to kill anything right. that's going on.
Yeah, so to me, none of that this makes sense. I mean, immigrants have really been the drivers of innovation and entrepreneurship in the United States, and you know the demonizing of the immigrants here out of Washington. First of all, it's counterproductive in a practical way, but it's false. It's a false narrative.
It is.
And nowhere in New York are we more reliant on immigrants, especially immigrant entrepreneurs, to fuel our economy. I'm sorry, but like I have no sympathy there.
Yeah. No, so. I don't blame you. All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Randy Pierce, thanks very much for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
The Lobbying Insider Podcast is a production of Davidoff, Hutcher & Citron, LLP, New York State's premier middle market law firm, practicing in more than 20 areas, including commercial litigation, economic development, real estate, and government affairs. Podcast is produced by Don Tesserero, and our platform manager is Monica Thomas. Be sure to subscribe, and you can get it where you get most podcasts, including Apple, Audible, Google, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Thanks for being with us.